Code Talker, Disc 5.
Chapter 26, The Black Beach. Our Navajo net on board the Bunker Hill was set up in the radio room just above the flag bridge at the very top of the ship. It made for a good place to see what happened on the island. Johnny Manuelito told me about it later. As the last boats of our first wave reached shore, Johnny watched from that flag bridge. He just set up to send and receive and was waiting for the first messages. The whole island was blanketed with smoke and dust, but he saw through his binoculars that we'd reached the beaches untouched. Just then, something came streaking down out of the sky, heading right at him. It was a shell from the Japanese guns that had suddenly opened fire. It hit the top deck a few feet below where he was standing. But instead of bursting on impact, it bounced off, went spinning down, ricocheted off the next deck, and blew up far below. Johnny stared down in silence for a moment. Things like that, he thought, make you feel glad you performed your ceremony. Then he jumped to his radio that had crackled into life as the shores of Iwo Jima burst into flame. 100 yards in from the beach, what had seemed like a walk in the park had turned into a swim in a sea of fire. The most intense storm of howitzer and mortar shells, machine gun, and small arms fire any of us had ever experienced was raining down on us. Blue-green vapor lines of Japanese tracer bullets stitched the air above our heads. Once again, I heard the sound that is one of the most awful things anyone can hear. The dull thud, between the sound of a slap and a punch, of a bullet hitting the body of a human being. I heard it again and again, followed by cries of pain from those who were not killed when burning pieces of lead struck them. There was no line of protection between us and the enemy ambush. Our alligators tried to make a quick crawl up the steep slope of the terrace so they could set up a fire line. The black sand was too loose and too deep. Spraying sand, a few of them reached the top of the terrace closest to the beach. But where we were, right below Suribachi, it was just plain impossible. Our amphibious boats turned around, roared back down onto the beach, and churned their way out into the water 50 yards or so. From there, they could at least fire over our heads. That 15-foot rise was just about as hard for a man to climb as for a tracked vehicle. Sand shifted out from under our feet as Smitty and I tried to scramble up the steep slope. My arms were sucked in up to my elbows as I tried to find my balance. Black sand flowed into my face and down my neck. Like trying to swim up a waterfall, Smitty grunted as he reached back and grabbed my arm to pull me after him. I didn't say anything. My mouth was too full of sand. Our work was worth it, though. When we finally reached the top, a big reward was waiting for us. Not only did we have a great view, but we were fully exposed to the enemy fire that started the exact instant the two of us got there. The Japanese had waited until we Americans had swarmed up the first slope and were like sitting ducks on the wide plain before the next terrace. Smitty and I fell to our bellies and scrambled like sand lizards to the only cover we could find, a little dip in the ground. I got out my radio while Smitty dug our foxhole deeper. More Marines were coming in behind us. They needed to know what was happening. I waved at Lieutenant Lewis, who was deepening his own foxhole 50 feet to the right of us. Before long, he had runners bringing me the messages I needed to send back to the ship. Those messages were a measure of how desperate things had become for us by 1100. Receiving steady fire from Grid 29B. Delivered to Green Beach 1. 5,000 rounds. 30 caliber belted. Airstrikes with 100-pound bombs at 132 North. Estimated battalion casualties, 60 killed. 2 radio men down. On board ship, the messages from our Navajo net coordinated gunfire, ensured resupply, and helped our commanders estimate what had to be done. Taking the island was going to require every available man. The ships carrying the 3rd Division were called in. Many of the things that happened during our first 3 days on Iwo Jima are hard for me to remember clearly, grandchildren. That may be just as well. When I think of that time, scattered pictures appear in my mind. Marines running through fire to hurl grenades into pillboxes. Wounded men limping forward into the fight with nothing more than pistols in their hands. A burning Sherman tank lifted right up into the air and flipped upside down by the explosion of a 500-pound bomb that had been buried as a mine. The still lifeless faces of men who had shared food with me, laughed and joked only hours before, men whose voices I would never hear again. Then there were the smells. The odor of sulfur was everywhere. It mixed with the burning gasoline from the flamethrowers and napalm bombs, the sharp tang of gunpowder, the overheated metal of machine gun barrels, so hot that they were melting. Worst of all was the stench of burning skin, so thick at times that many lost their appetites. By the night of that first long day, though, all were so hungry that they wolfed down whatever they had with them. I remember brushing big green flies and black grit off my steak sandwich before eating it in the foxhole Smitty and I constantly had to keep digging out as the hot sifting sand flowed back over our feet. I also hear clear voices when I remember that time. I hear those voices and my own heart grows calm again. They are Navajo voices speaking strongly in our sacred language, speaking over the concussions of the exploding shells so close that the pressure in the air made it hard to breathe, speaking above the deadly whirr of shrapnel, the snap of Japanese rifles, and the ping of bullets bouncing off our radio equipment, speaking calmly, speaking even when our enemies tried to confuse us by getting on our frequency to scream loudly in our ears and bang pots and pans, speaking, speaking through that day and the next, even when our voices grew hoarse, we didn't stop. Our Navajo nets kept everything connected like a spider's strand spanning distant branches. The winds of battle never broke our web. As the battle for Iwo Jima raged all around us, our voices held it together. Our first major objective on the island had been to take Mount Suribachi, but the fierce Japanese resistance made it almost impossible. All we could do was creep forward a few feet at a time. It took us 4 days to move halfway up the slope, taking terrible casualties all the way. Friday was the fifth day of fighting. Company E was directed to capture the summit. By now, Mount Suribachi's caves and chambers were almost empty. Its blockhouses and pillboxes had been shattered. Howitzers and mortars, naval gunfire, aerial bombing, and men on foot with hand grenades and satchel charges had done their work. 40 men from Company E crawled on their stomachs up the rocky slope that was almost vertical at the top, avoiding any trails for fear they were mined. I was not one of them. I was in a foxhole farther down the mountain, sending progress reports from our lieutenant. At 10:15, the 40 men spilled over the side of the cone into the crater. Not one enemy was in sight. The Marines had taken the mountain, and as they climbed, one of those guys had found a metal pipe discarded on the slope. They'd brought a small American flag with them. The little flag was fastened to the end of that pipe, and the pole was jabbed into the soft soil at the north rim of the crater. 6 men raised that flag, including Private Louis Charlo, a Crow Indian Marine from Montana. Sergeant Louis Lowry, a photographer for Leatherneck magazine, snapped pictures of the men posing around the flag. Just then, 2 Japanese soldiers who'd been hidden in a cave attacked them with hand grenades and a sword. Jimmy Robison, a Marine who'd refused to pose for the picture, shot one of the Japanese soldiers before he could get to the flag, and Louis Charlo took care of the other one. Sergeant Lowry's camera was smashed in the fight, but the roll of film inside it was saved, and his pictures got printed in Leatherneck. I was too far down the slope to see that flag, but some of the Marines farther up from me saw the stars and stripes go up and started shouting and celebrating. Word of that flag raising flowed down the slope as fast as a stream of sweet water. One of the white guys in my company yelled over to me from where he was pinned down by enemy fire on the north slope of Moriyama, a ridge in clear view of Suribachi. "Hey, Chief," he shouted, "they raised the stars and stripes. It's over. It's all over now." "Not here," I yelled back to him. ducking as Japanese bullets whizzed over my head. Teddy Draper was the code talker farthest up the slope of Mount Suribachi. He couldn't see that flag either, but his sergeant told him to send the message. So Teddy was the one who first spoke the words in our code, radioing back to General Smith at his command post on the beach. It was a long message because many of the words, such as Suribachi, had to be spelled out. Two, 5th Marine Division, Info, ADC, from LT-228 E Company, 3rd Platoon. 1st Lieutenant H.G. Schreier's platoon raised U.S. flag and secured Mount Suribachi at 10:20. All over the beachhead, people greeted the news with cheers and shouts. Having that American flag go up was like New Year's Eve. Some men were so moved that they cried. People were ringing bells, blowing whistles, and sounding horns from the boats. On the beach, where so many had died, a man dressed just like every other Marine got that message and nodded his head. That man knew how hard the other armed forces had tried to terminate the Marine Corps, even while we did the hardest jobs on those islands. "This means a Marine Corps for the next 500 years," that man said. He was James Forrestal, the Secretary of the Navy, and he was standing right next to General Howling Mad Smith and two admirals. As far as they were concerned, we had won. But for those of us Marines who were still in the thick of it, the fight for Iwo Jima was far from over. During that struggle to take Suribachi, three more of our Marine code talkers ended their war. Paul Kintlichitny, Sam Morgan, Willie Nota. When Paul was hit by machine gun fire and died, he called out to Jimmy Gleason, the other Navajo with him. "Tell my folks," were Paul's last words. Jimmy got into a foxhole, but was trapped in the crossfire. His ankle had been shattered. He lay there for 2 days before anyone found him. He ended up losing his leg just below the knee. Jimmy survived to go home, even though the Gallup Independent reported that he had been killed in action. Mount Suribachi was just the southern tip of Iwo Jima, but capturing it meant that we were on our way to winning. Even the Japanese knew they were going to be defeated when they lost their stronghold. I learned later that many of the enemy soldiers wanted to give up, but were too ashamed to surrender or too afraid of their officers. That was why they fought on until almost every one of the 20,000 Japanese soldiers was dead. Our victory was also purchased at an awful cost in American casualties. 6,821 Marines were killed, and another 19,207 were wounded. During the taking of Iwo Jima, I lost some of my white buddies, too. I haven't said enough about how many of the white men who fought in the Pacific became my pals. I had many friends. Too many friends. I say too many because having a lot of friends during war can be a painful thing. It's not like having friends here at home in peacetime. If you have a good buddy, grandchildren, do you not look forward to seeing him when each new day dawns? If you have many friends, your life is full. When you are young and are living in peace, it seems as if your friends will always be there with you. It's different in war. Another friend is another person you might lose at any instant. Each new day, each minute, may be the last one when you will see your friend. That guy who shared a canteen of water with you, who teased you about your fear of snakes, or showed you pictures of his mother and father, can vanish in one moment as brief and shocking as a flash of lightning. It was March 4th, before dawn. 3 weeks after the flag raising on Suribachi, it had been a cold, rainy night. "Hey, Chief," the man next to me on my left said, his helmet dripping with water. "Did y'all do another one of them rain dances?" It did almost seem as if we Marines were rainmakers. Wherever we went in the Pacific campaign, Guadalcanal, Bougainville, Guam, Pavavu, the rain always seemed to follow us. It was always the same. But there was no confusing where we were now. That harsh odor of Iwo Jima's sulfur smoke was always with us. Imagine the smell that comes just when you strike a match, and then think of it filling the air all the time. That's how it was. Our objective was a place called Hill 362, southwest of Morayame Village. Although the sun hadn't risen, we could see it clearly ahead. Harassing fire had been trained on it all night. It was lit up by white phosphorus bursts. Then the shelling stopped. It was 0500, time to move silently through the dark. We were not to fire our weapons until fired upon. That was an easy order for me to observe, grandchildren. I was always so busy with my radio equipment that firing a weapon was the last thing I could do. As soon as the first light of the sun struck us, so did the enemy. We were raked by fire from our flanks, from the front, and even from the rear. I heard a cry from that man on my left and turned to see my friend Georgia Boy holding his own throat. Blood was spurting through his fingers, and his helmet had been knocked off. A neck wound is bad. The big arteries there have so much pressure that all the blood in your body can be pumped out in a few minutes. Someone was yelling for a medic. It took me a moment to realize that the person was yelling in Navajo. "Azit ne kahe?" Then I realized I was the one doing the yelling, as I pressed my hands down onto Georgia Boy's neck, trying to stem the flow of blood. A corpsman with the small circle of his profession on his helmet knelt by my side. In the Pacific War, our medics didn't wear red crosses. The Japanese didn't observe the usual rules of warfare that forbade trying to kill medical personnel. A red cross was just a more visible target for a sniper. I moved aside as the medic took over. We had to keep moving. My radio was needed farther up front. Georgia Boy's face was pale and his legs were trembling. It was the last I saw of him on Iwo Jima. On March 16th, 26 days after D-Day, organized resistance was declared at an end. There were still caves and isolated emplacements holding out, but the battle had been won. On March 25th, we began withdrawing to head back to Guam. The final thing I remember seeing of Iwo Jima was the American flag still waving from the peak of Mount Suribachi as we sailed away. You have probably seen that picture taken of six Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi. It was published all over the world. You can see it here on this medal. In Washington, D.C., at the Marine Corps Memorial, there is a big statue of those Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima. But if you remember my description of how Mount Suribachi was taken, you'll realize that this flag wasn't the first one. 2 hours after Mount Suribachi was captured, an Associated Press photographer named Joe Rosenthal decided to go up to the top of the mountain, even though everyone told him he was too late. He arrived just at the moment when that first flag was being taken down. "Colonel Johnson wants to keep this one for a souvenir," he was told, "so we're going to put up a bigger one." As soon as the first flag was down, Joe Rosenthal began to take pictures of the Marines putting up that second one. One of those pictures became the most famous photograph from World War II. Ira Hayes, a Pima Indian friend of mine from Arizona, is the one farthest on the very left. You can see him reaching for the flagpole, but not quite touching it. He and the other five became famous because of that one photograph. It embarrassed some of them, because they all knew it was a staged picture. I think that even though there was no fighting on top of Mount Suribachi at that time, those six men deserved the praise they were given. They were brave and fought hard. Three of them were killed not long after that photograph. The other three, including Ira, were shipped back to the States. Ira toured the country for the Marine Corps, promoting the sale of war bonds. When they made Ira into a celebrity, he didn't feel comfortable about it. I think that's one of the reasons he drank so much. Some of us, like Wilsey Bitsy and me, had been friends with Ira even before the war. So we Navajos saw a lot of Ira after he got back home, all of us being veterans and back in Arizona. All of us being Indians. Ira would tell us how he just couldn't get the war out of his head. He kept seeing the men who had been wounded and hearing their voices. He didn't like to look at that famous photo of himself raising the flag. "I wish you had been there with me in that picture," he used to say to Wilsey and me. "It's so lonely being there forever without another Indian."